Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820. This hour on the program, we're scheduled to take a look at some of America's urban schools and ask the question, 50 years after the Brown versus Board of Education desegregation decision, are some urban American school systems persistently and increasingly segregated? Now, segregated racially, economically, along class lines? And if they are, the question, can students in such segregated schools ever receive even a minimally adequate education? Are these schools, in fact, separate and unequal? That's the question. Scheduled as my guest, education journalist Susan Eaton. She explores a case in point, the Harvard, Connecticut school system. Hartford. Hartford is the capital city of the wealthiest state in the nation, but it's a very impoverished city with an impoverished black and Latino population. Nearly 80% of the city's population is black and Latino, with whites congregated in wealthier suburbs. My guest focuses on one elementary school and talks about a fine teacher and a good student to tell a greater story of what she says is deliberate social engineering that has created economic and educational segregation. In other words, she says if you see economic and educational segregation, it has not happened by chance or by choice. There has been some deliberate social engineering on the part of governments and on the part of private entities as well. So also to tell the story of a lawsuit that sought to address the deleterious educational effects of that segregation and the inadequate response of the state of Connecticut, which has left a generation of minority students poorly educated and with little opportunity to enter into mainstream America and share in mainstream America's many benefits. It's a story not limited to Hartford and Connecticut alone. Susan Eaton is an award-winning journalist specializing in education. She's the former assistant director of the Project on School Desegregation at Harvard. Her new book is The Children in Room E4. It's subtitled American Education on Trial. Welcome to Open Line, Susan Eaton. Good to have you here.
Hi.
And we're at 614-292-8513 when you'd like to join the conversation. Susan, we're talking here about racial segregation in the schools of Hartford and other major American cities, but also an economic kind of segregation too. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Because what you see is, and in the classroom where I spent an enormous amount of time writing this book, there was, racial segregation brings with it economic segregation, and it's something that we academics often refer to as concentrated poverty. And it's concentrated poverty that really brings together all of the social problems that, exist out on the street, in homes, wherever, that come into the classroom and really weigh on a social institution and make it difficult, no matter how wonderful the teachers might be, how great a leader the principal might be, and how willing and hardworking the students might be, just make it incredibly difficult to provide an equal educational opportunity.
Mm-hmm. You point out that in Hartford, Connecticut, nearly 80% of the city's population is black or Latino, and it's an impoverished city, and with the wealthier suburbs, the middle-class suburbs, inhabited for the most part by whites, and is the black and Latino population of the school system, that is to say students, about 95%, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's a population that that we see mirrored all across the country. I mean, I'm not exactly sure what the statistics are in, say, Cincinnati and Cleveland, for example, but I think they're probably pretty close to that. And in terms of concentrated poverty, it's probably quite similar as well. But yeah, 94% of the students in the city of Hartford are racial minorities. And in the school that I spent a significant amount of time, 2/3 of the families there were low-income families.
Mm-hmm. And you say this concentration racially and economically is no accident, that there have been policies through the years, a kind of social engineering, you say, that brought this about.
Yes, absolutely. There was a series of, one of the things that, when I went down to Hartford to write this book, I first initially thought that it was going to be a very quick book just on the legal case, and then I realized I really couldn't tell the story of the legal case without understanding the lives and the educational opportunities for the children that the case was designed to assist, right? And then I realized, much to my dismay, that I really couldn't tell the story about where we are without really explaining in great detail, and I hope engagingly, mm-hmm. about how we got here in the first place. But yes, absolutely. There is a series of, beginning as far back as the 1930s and 40s, a series of federal, state, and local housing policies that ended up corralling blacks and then later Latinos into certain neighborhoods in the city, and then provided and then the government later, the federal government, provided a series of incentives for people to move out to the suburbs in the late 50s and 60s during a time in which African Americans especially were discriminated against in the suburban housing market. And then you add to it the fact that insurance companies redlined, banks redlined, making it impossible for people in the city to get loans, and then if they did get mortgages, making it even harder, more expensive for them to buy insurance for their home in the city. So it didn't make economic sense for anyone who could during this period to stay in the city.
Mm-hmm. But if you're African American and you wanted to move out of the city into a middle class suburb that was turning out to be white, there were going to be all kinds of obstacles thrown at.
Yes, during that time, yeah, and there's plenty of documentation from numerous cities all across the country of the fact that real estate agents, realtors steered whites to the suburbs and steered blacks looking to buy homes to certain neighborhoods in Hartford or in the other cities in Connecticut. And as late as the late 1980s, the newspaper, the city of Hartford, did a pretty thorough investigation, and they had a black reporter posing as a potential home buyer, and then they had some white reporters posing as potential home buyers, and they found that the black reporters' financial qualifications were scrutinized and they were steered to particular neighborhoods. So these things are real. And then what happens is something more subtle, is that later on, now because of federal fair housing laws, because of enforcement in the fair housing centers, oftentimes in local levels work to prevent housing discrimination, and they've done a very good job of that. But what we have set up now is this kind of psychological distance, that even if, say a mom is not happy in living in a dangerous neighborhood, the idea of moving to a middle-class suburb, even if perhaps there were affordable housing there, just seems like such another world.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a very, very difficult concept for them to even get their heads around.
Jumping back a little bit, of course, to compound all this problem of the – first of all, there were deliberate federal government policies that encouraged – that resulted in an encouragement of whites to get middle-class homes in the suburbs, but not African-Americans, right?
That's absolutely right. And it was during a time where there was rampant and well-documented housing discrimination. Yeah, it was extremely difficult. And then the government did other things that obviously, were not intended to create segregation. For example – the high-speed highways that that the government financed, the state government and federal government financed, simply made suburban living more attractive, for example, okay? During that period, the 60s, when the highways were getting built and suburban living looked to be more convenient, people could live in the suburbs and get back into the cities for their jobs very easily. Again, that was a time in which blacks were very strongly discouraged from moving anywhere but to the city of but staying in the city of Hartford. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, to compound the problem, there had been good jobs in Hartford, manufacturing jobs, other jobs that, like in many cities in the East Coast, they vanished over time.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, when you think about segregation, you say, well, black people living together in one part of a city, isn't bad in and of itself, but this segregation was it was compounded in the time in which a lot of the jobs that had sustained and that had kept very strong African-American and Puerto Rican families in these neighborhoods were starting to vanish. They were starting to melt away. They were moving to other parts of the United States, and they were moving overseas. And so what was left were these very unstable, low-paying, and now what we have now largely, service positions, okay, like, a hotel maid or a cashier, things that really don't help sustain a family. And all of these factors, compounded together, one on top of the other, is exactly what caused the separation between the haves and the have-nots.
Mm-hmm. My guest, education journalist Susan Eaton, her new book is The Children in Room E4, subtitled American Education on Trial, 614-292-8513, in a few minutes, if you want to join the conversation. So it took those two elements. Number one, a social engineering that encouraged segregation, and secondly, the departure of these jobs, because as you say, if there were separate segregated communities but jobs were plentiful, maybe that wouldn't have been so bad.
Yes, it wouldn't have been so bad because to add to that, what happened is, of course, you know, some good things. For example, I think that individual racism, for example, I think has been on the decline in this country for years. I think we're, generally speaking, ordinary people are much more tolerant today than we were, say, in the 1950s. And so that has made it easier for, say, people, black and Latinos who have the means to move to wherever they want. In addition, the fair housing laws that were enacted by the federal government are often enforced, you know, if there's a fair housing center around anymore, are also enforced vigorously. And so, therefore, it is easier now for middle-class blacks or even working-class blacks and Latinos to move more freely to where they want. And so that's a wonderful development for our country. However, one needs to remember that what happens then is that it's only the poorest people who are left behind in the types of neighborhoods that I wrote about in my book, The Children in Rumi 4, like the north end of Hartford, like sections of Cincinnati and Cleveland and Columbus, mm-hmm. I'm quite sure, show the same sorts of patterns.
Also, now the school district lines in Hartford, and we should say this is not limited to Hartford, Connecticut, they were drawn essentially along racial lines, were they?
Well, sure. I mean, they weren't drawn specifically. You know, when no one sat in the State House in Hartford, Connecticut and said, ooh, we're going to keep all those black kids over there and all those white kids over there. It wasn't anything as sinister as that. But it was a kind of unthinking, unforward-looking way of organizing school districts. So basically what happened is because we have this history of drawing school districts along town and city lines is that then state officials and local officials would build schools right on top of this segregated pattern that had been created by racial discrimination. So just it looks like an innocent act. Well, we're going to put up a school in Simsbury, Connecticut, say, mm-hmm. you know, or we're going to put up a school in the suburbs of Columbus, Ohio. Well, no one is saying we're going to put up an all-white school and black kids can't go to that school. But essentially, that's what you're doing, you know, especially if the schools were built in around the 1970s.
So as a result of this, there was a lawsuit, Sheff versus O'Neill, right, with 19
right.
plaintiffs, including a school child, more than one school child, about they said it violated these state-enforced school district boundary lines that essentially de facto accomplished segregation. They said violated the Connecticut Constitution, which guaranteed what kind of an education?
An equal educational opportunity for all children. And it's very interesting to point out that most state constitutions, if not all, have some sort of provision either directly for equal educational opportunity or for equal protection of the laws. And it's important to point out, too, is that the U.S. Constitution, it's been ruled by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973, that there is no provision for equal educational opportunity in the United States Constitution. So that's one of the reasons why we see a lot of legal actions on the state level for equal educational opportunity. But the lawyer's argument in Sheff is one that I think is, you know, basically true, which is that the segregation and concentrated poverty that characterized the Hartford public school system, okay, just as it characterizes, you know, hundreds if not thousands of school districts all across the country, those two things alone deprived students of an equal educational opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the lawyers would say, yes, we hear a lot about people saying, I don't care about racial integration. I don't care if my kid sits next to a white kid. He doesn't need that to learn. And that's absolutely true. But what's been shown time and time again is that this condition of concentrated poverty absolutely, unequivocally, does negatively affect the quality of a child's education, mm-hmm. you know, generally speaking.
Tell me how it does. Give us a story.
Okay, well, two things. I mean, one is the kind of psychological effect that I think it has upon children. okay, that when I was writing about, I really wanted to focus in writing this book, you know, about a legal case, I really wanted to focus just as intensely upon the children that the case was designed to assist. You know, for example, we've got children living in the city of Hartford, incredibly eager, hardworking, ready to learn in a lot of ways, caring very deeply about their education, encouraged by a fabulous teacher, who have never seen, for example, a pond, who've never seen, never don't doesn't can't really grasp the concept. These kids live in New England, can't really grasp the concept of a frozen lake, a lake frozen, have never been sledding, don't know what a snow fort is, can't visualize, had never heard the word toboggan, okay? And children who really see themselves, who are starting in third and fourth grade, to understand their position in the world. And they see themselves and they view themselves as a part, as separate from the rest of American society. While they have these incredible dreams, they also are hit now and again by the fact that they are not really a part of the larger American society. You know, for example, the kids were taking a field trip one day. You know, they're in fourth grade at this time, and they are going out for, as part of their field trip, they go out to the suburbs to see what the suburbs are like. So that's sort of the situation that we're starting at, where the suburbs are considered an exotic location to go and visit. So the kids are on the bus, and they're having a good time, and I'm sitting with the teacher and talking, and then a little girl is walking up the aisle of the bus with complete terror in her eyes, this beautiful little black girl, and she whispers to her teacher, "Miss Luddy, are we going to a white school?" And the teacher turns around to her and has to say, "Yes, honey, we are. Most of the children who go to this school are white." And then after the little girl left, still looking terrified, the teacher looked at me and said, "Can you believe this? This girl just asked me, are we going to a white school? Well, maybe I should have told her yes, and you go to a black school." And so there are things like that that happened over and over and over again. But then from an educational standpoint, what happens when you've got a school full of children from low-income backgrounds is that all of the problems, all of the inequities that exist outside of school that we don't talk about anymore, like family instability, like, you know, regular exposure to violence, you know, not having, you know, good nutrition, you know, whatever, lack of exposure to life outside of their neighborhood kind of weighs on these classrooms. So that the number one priority of a lot of urban schools, not all, but a lot of urban schools, is kind of taming this chaos that comes in, right, from this unstable environment that exists outside of the schools. And so this kind of culture of keeping order begins to take priority over, say, things like having pleasant social relationships. You know, talking in the lunchroom is often prohibited in the interest of keeping order, is keeping this chaos, keeping a lid on this chaos, right?
What does the chaos consist of in the community?
The chaos consists of, in the particular community that I'm talking about, which is in some ways extreme, but it's really not that different from a lot of inner city communities, is a regular dose of street slayings of young African-American men, for example. Young African-American men who the children are often related to or knew or cared about, who were in their universe. Regular arrests for drug deals on the streets constantly, you know, walking around the neighborhood and seeing open-air drug deals is very, very common. So this is part of the children's kind of world, okay? We have a problem in this neighborhood where young men who father children are not playing very active roles, for example, in the children's education. So we have numerous examples of single parents and oftentimes grandparents who are incredibly overburdened and raising children in this environment and doing the absolute best they can. I mean, one of the boys in the classroom, for example, he starts off kind of mirroring a lot of the behaviors that he sees around him. A lot of the men in his family have spent time in prison, a lot of drug addiction problems in his family, very, very common. He lives in a housing project right across from the street, and his grandmother, who's not sick, but she's an older woman. She's elderly. She has problems with her legs and her feet and her back, and she's raising 8 children in a very small public housing project in Hartford. So this kid comes in, and and then his uncle who lives with him gets into a serious amount of trouble with the law. Very, very common. There's a murder in right around the corner from where he lives, and then he comes into the classroom, just as an example, and his teacher's responsibility is to make him care about fractions. And she can do that. She actually manages to do that. But the problem isn't that this child is in this classroom. The problem is that nearly every child is facing some sort of similar circumstance. And so we've got this disproportionate burden that's placed on our challenge, if you want to use a euphemism, that's placed upon the city of Hartford, which simply doesn't exist out in these suburban communities.
You focus on one extraordinary student whose name is Jeremy.
Right.
Being raised by his grandmother Anna and his aunt Nina, and they're all his siblings, of course. And he's almost in a state of lockdown, when he goes home, because of, his caring grandmother says, "Look, I don't want you out on the streets. I don't want you subjected to the violence that we see 2 doors down from us."
Right.
And so he's an extraordinary kid, and he manages to surface through all of this and do very well. But nonetheless, you can see this is a very difficult situation. I guess doesn't his aunt Anita gives him a bicycle, right, and will only let him ride it around very close by where she can keep an eye on him?
That's right. I mean, I just remember this day going into the neighborhood and seeing him riding his bike and thinking, oh, this is great. They managed to like pull the money together to get him a bike. This is fabulous. And but then I realized he wasn't going anywhere on the bike. He was just riding in these tight half circles because his grandmother quite wisely was saying, no, I'm sorry, you can't pedal anywhere out of my field of vision. You need to stay here. And she was right, because just a few weeks later, there was just down the block, there was a murder of a young guy. And one of the other things that you see all around the neighborhood are these makeshift memorials, to the murder victims. And the thing is with Jeremy, again, he was living in a situation that's really common, and that is he was being raised by a grandmother who loved him. She was doing the absolute best she could, but she suffered from depression, which is a very common ailment that I saw over and over and over again in the inner city. And I think that this depression is not just genetic. I think that it is, and there's been studies that have shown this, is that it's environmental. It's caused by, living in an incredibly stressful environment, incredibly stressful situation, and that these kinds of conditions can't help but affect the children in the classroom, in E4, in the Simpson-Waverly School that I wrote about. And our educational conversations go on as if, these things don't matter, we're going to see miracles. There are miracles everywhere in our urban schools. Well, this school that I went to go visit it precisely because everybody was telling me, this is a miracle, this is a miracle school. And it wasn't a miracle school.
Even though I had a fine principal and a very good teacher, that Mrs. Lois Luddy, who was a kind disciplinarian, you say, who really related beautifully to the kids. But nonetheless, it's a real uphill battle, huh?
Yeah, it's a real uphill battle, and it also, she struggled against, this knowledge that she had of, what happens to most of the kids. And I think I write in my book that, even the best and the brightest rarely provided her with happy endings.
Mm-hmm.
And all through the book, one of the things that kept happening is we'd see, there was this juxtaposition, and it was so sad because, you go into third grade and here are these little beautiful children and they all are trying really hard to please this teacher who cares about them. And, things are looking really good for them. And even though a lot of them face really challenging home environments and, they're surrounded by violence, they really have this kind of light and this excitement for learning still about them. And yet while I'm watching them and spending time with them, there are all these murders and beatings and arrests going on in the neighborhood. And then when I, you know, go through the Hartford Current newspaper and talk to Lois about it, she's like, oh, yeah, he was my student. Oh, yeah, he was a really good writer, that kid. Or she'd say, oh, he was the sweetest kid. He had the most wonderful dad who tried really hard. And, you know, just these incredibly incredible stories. And I would say, like, one of her former students was shot during the time. I remember William Ashley, who... And she said, oh, he was the most handsome little boy. You know, look, look, look. And she went over to her desk, and she found an old picture of him. And she said, I remember he struggled in school, but the year that I had him, he was just a delight. You know, and I think, oh, my God, you know, what is that foreshadow? Mm-hmm. You know, and so I purposely put those little moments in the book, like another one of Miss Letty's students was arrested, you know, wielding a gun and aiming it at so-and-so. So.
Yeah, so she's going to lose. She knows even with these very young kids who have dreams of what they want to do when they grow up, who are really excited about learning, she's going to lose them.
Well, that lingers in the background, you know, the back of her mind. I mean, she refuses to think. She refuses, you know, she fights against pessimism. It's one of the amazing things about her is that, you know, she really, even last night, I actually saw her and we were with a couple of the kids, and there was one of the kids in her class who I wrote about, and he is very, very interested in masonry. And there she was, you know, at this event, and she found someone who wanted to talk to him about being a junior counselor, and they were building some buildings at this camp, and he could be a junior counselor, and then he could also kind of hang out with these guys who were doing the construction and see how they worked. And here she was, you know, still, I mean, this kid is now in high school, and she's still working really hard against, you know, these forces of negativity that are everywhere in this kid's life, and yet she's still believing that he could do okay, and I really think that he could. And, you know, a lot of people have criticized the book saying, well, there's no happy ending, you know, and I said, well, you know what, maybe some of the kids, maybe they will give me a happy ending, and I think he's one of the kids that will.
Susan Eaton is an education journalist. Her new book is The Children in Room E4, subtitled American Education on Trial. And after these messages, we'll be back with my guest and your phone calls at WOSU 820 AM Columbus, on the web at WOSU.org.
Aravind Adiga's new novel is set in the New India, a kind of wild, wild east of startups and call centers.
In the old days, there were 1,000 castes and destinies in India. These days, there are just two castes, men with big bellies and men with small bellies, and only two destinies, eat or get eaten up.
I'm Scott Simon. The new novel, The White Tiger, plus the latest news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Weekend Edition Saturday begins tomorrow morning starting at 8 a.m. right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. This is an encore presentation of the best of Open Line, so no phone calls, please. Currently, it is 51 degrees at 10:33. Your membership with WOSU provides for the news and information you rely on. And in this pivotal election year, your support is more important than ever. Becoming a member is easy when you go online to WOSU.org/give. Thank you for your continued support of WOSU 820, NPR News. And WOSU invites you to join us at COSI at the Ross Media Lab for a digital scrapbooking class. The class is Saturday, May 24th at 10 a.m. For more information, including registration, visit WOSU.org/Media Lab. Cloudy skies today and a high near 62. Skies clear overnight tonight with a low of 48.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820. I'm Fred Anderle. We're talking with Susan Eaton. She's an award-winning journalist specializing in education, former assistant director of the Project on School Desegregation at Harvard University. We're talking about the city of Hartford, Connecticut, and their school system, which is greatly segregated. Nearly 95% of the city's children are African-American or Latino, and the districts are drawn such that, indeed, surrounding, of course, we have the middle-class white suburbs. And Susan points out that there was deliberate social engineering that has created in Hartford, Connecticut, and in many other cities around the country, think Ohio, economic and educational segregation, both, not just racial segregation, but also economic segregation, with the city of Hartford being impoverished and middle-class white suburbs around doing okay. And she says this was no accident. And she says the difficulty with this is not only is there a racial segregation, but also because of the terrible income possibilities, with many good jobs and many good industrial and manufacturing jobs and other jobs having left Hartford, Connecticut, for other parts of the world, for the South, etc. And that's a story many cities around the country repeat. You have not only racial segregation, but you have a segregation of poverty as well. And this leaves a generation of minority students feeling that they don't have a chance. We're at 614-292-8513. Susan, before we go to our callers, then what you're saying is that, and you spent years with the children in room E4, right? This is no short-term project.
I did. I went in at the beginning of their third grade school year and stayed with them because their teacher did this process that's called looping, which basically is a fancy name for staying with kids over 2 years. And so she stayed with them over 2 years, and so did I. And then when the children moved on to fifth grade, I didn't spend time in their classroom, but I'd come to school and I'd eat lunch with them, and I'd sort of spend time with a lot of them outside of school, you know, in the neighborhood and in their houses and that sort of thing.
So these kids, in other words, to go to a middle-class suburb, which is by definition a white suburb, it's an entirely different world to them. One in which, as you say, it's a field trip, huh?
Yeah, basically. I mean, it really is a field trip. They actually do take field trips to suburbia to see what suburbia is like, which is a good program, absolutely, and of excellent educational quality, the program that the suburban and the urban districts designed to expose, you know, the white kids, also the white middle-class kids, to life in the city and to children in the city and really break up some stereotypes. But if you step back and look at it, you realize the absurdity of this, that this is what's kind of replacing this idea of true integration. And at the end of the day, of course, everybody has to go back to their segregated schools and their completely separate worlds.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our callers now. Lee is on the line. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Fred and guest. I was wondering, in her book, is there a solution? I mean, this problem is enormous now, and the government does not seem to have the will when it comes to black people. And what is the solution? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call. Well, I guess solutions plural, huh? I don't know.
Yeah.
It seems
there
overwhelming.
There are, you know, and I think the caller asked the question that keeps getting asked over and over again, and that I really appreciate that question, which is, you know, okay, so you've shown me the problem, you've shown me that I should care. Now what do I do? Well, in the back of the book, I do point to several different, you know, policy options, okay, and one of which is a lot of which lie in housing, because I think that ultimately it's a much more organic way to create racial integration and to break up these concentrations of poverties which characterize so many of our cities. There have been a lot of programs instituted by the federal government, and that have been embraced by Republicans as well as Democrats. You know, for example, there's a program called Moving to Opportunity that allowed poor minority families, or poor families, I guess you can't use race anymore, right, to move from impoverished, high concentrated poverty neighborhoods to more stable middle-class neighborhoods.
Wait, you mean they get vouchers to help pay for rent,
mm-hmm,
or what?
Absolutely right, mm-hmm. Yes. And they received, in the best cases, they received counseling that, you know, helped them, you know, understand what their choices were in these different communities, that helped them find housing, and ultimately helped them, you know, transition into, you know, making this big change. And the results of many of these different programs, there was one, for example, instituted, there was a similar one instituted as a result of a lawsuit in Chicago called Gautreaux, which showed incredibly positive results, not just in terms of children's educational accomplishments, which were substantial, especially in the Chicago program, which was very well designed, but also in areas like people's mental health, you know, the kinds of things that I talked about before, just bringing people to a new environment in which they're not completely stressed out all the time and worried about, you know, being a victim of violence was really important. There are also voluntary school desegregation programs across the country, which I don't want to go into too much detail, but you know, whose future may not be so secure because of two cases that are before the Supreme Court right now that would outlaw voluntary school desegregation programs that used race in any way to achieve racial diversity in school assignments. But and these programs have proven pretty successful over the years. And what we find is that, the advocates don't just exist in the African-American and the Latino communities, but in the white communities. You know, a lot of white educators, white teachers, and white school superintendents in suburban communities are realizing, oh, my God, you know, there are such huge benefits for our kids, you know, for the kids out in suburbia, to get some exposure to what the world is like outside of their little town and to help prepare them for being citizens in the larger society.
How do these voluntary desegregation systems work?
Just basically, suburban communities agree that they will, you know, accept students from the urban communities that are right near them, and then the students, you know, will volunteer, for example. I mean, no one is forcing these kids to get on a bus and go anywhere. Their families would volunteer for them to go out to these suburban communities, and then some government, in the case of Massachusetts and in the case of Connecticut, for example, the state pays for bus transportation to take the children to these communities. Now, and I should say that, like, for example, in the city of Boston, where, you know, I wrote a book called The Other Boston Busing Story, and it was specifically about this voluntary school desegregation program, because everybody associates Boston with this, you know, this disaster of school desegregation. But meanwhile, we have in the city of Boston a waiting list of 14,000 students who are signing up to try to go to predominantly white suburban schools in the region. So it's not that people are completely disenchanted with the idea of racial integration or desegregation. It's the question of, once they think that there's a quality education at the end of that bus ride, then yeah, it looks as if they really will sign up for it, because the waiting lists are long in every city that has a program like this.
And these voluntary desegregation and integration programs, are outcomes measured for the students who go to the suburban schools? Do they do better?
Yeah, it would be such an expensive prospect to do a real longitudinal study, a contemporary longitudinal study, and I think it's something that really should be done. But there's been enormous amounts of research done just on long-term outcomes of desegregation in general, and that have been consistently positive over the years. Yeah, I mean, my book was a study of, you know, 65 graduates of the program who talked about, you know, their perceptions of the effects of the program on their lives. And the results, even though a lot of them told me, you know, well, when I was, you know, one of, you know, 15 black children in a wealthy suburban school coming from the city, it was difficult. It was a challenge. And there were moments when I wanted to just get out of there. But, you know, as time went on, I realized that, you know, this experience has really made me comfortable in these white settings where there was opportunity that I wanted. And I went into these settings and I felt comfortable and I persisted, even in moments that I felt uncomfortable, and I persevered.
Mm-hmm. Susan Eaton is a journalist specializing in education, former assistant director of the Project on School Desegregation at Harvard, and her new book is The Children in Room E4. Don is next. Hello, Don.
I was calling. I'm listening to this story about Hartford, Connecticut, and I'm going, wait, that could be my neighborhood. That could be my school, my neighborhood school that my daughter went to last year. And we actually, and I could be that single mom, but the school, our neighborhood school, when she went to school in first grade last year, she was one of two little white girls, and everybody else, and that's fine. You know, I appreciate the diversity in my community, but it was so difficult because the whole culture is different than the way that I grew up in my suburban white neighborhood. And I feel so bad for the teachers. I totally respect the teachers in the Columbus Public Schools, and I have the utmost reverence for what they do, because they have such, as you, your euphemism, challenges to deal with. Right. My daughter had such trouble last year, not because of the teaching, not because of the content, but the classroom dynamics.
Yeah.
And when she played school, she'd come home and play school, and she was yelling all the time at her fake little students, her little stuffed animals. She had to yell to get them under control, and I felt so bad. And the truth is that when the voucher systems were offered to our school, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but we'd been in academic emergency in our neighborhood and school for, the right number of years, and they were offered the vouchers, and I took them, and I ran.
Yeah.
And I feel guilty because part of me feels like I'm deserting my neighborhood school. And then the other part of me feels like, but what doesn't my daughter deserve to see functional children?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the hardest part for me with that was when we went to the voucher school, she's back in. Now she's in a private school, and I take her out to the suburbs every day. But what I'm realizing, I had some disillusionment the first few weeks, and I realized when I looked inside, it was because I was used to her being the best kid in the class. I was used to getting these glowing praises from the principal and the teacher about how good she is and how wonderful it is to have a student like her. And now in the suburban school, she's just like all the other kids. I'm like, oh, what happened to my star student? And then a few weeks later, I realized, wait, not only is she not a star student, but we are the dysfunctional family. Yeah. I am the single mom that struggles to get my kid to school every day and doesn't always get her book bag packed appropriately and doesn't always get her things turned
too.
In.
And so then I start single, feeling guilty. I definitely still can't get the backpack together, right?
Yeah. So then I start feeling guilty that I'm bringing, our neighborhood troubles to their little suburban school. And
well, Susan, your response.
That's a fascinating story. I think that what this story illustrates is the extreme kind of separateness of these worlds, right?
Really?
Where, you're going from, you're really at like one type of world where the standards are a certain way, mm-hmm. and where the treatment of children perhaps is one certain way. And the need for order, is paramount. And then you're shifted to this other environment where the rules are completely different, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so think about...
And the expectations are different.
Yeah,
It was good enough just to get the kid to school. Now I'm expected to get him to school on time and totally prepared for the day.
And with the homework and doing extra work on, on everything. And you're supposed to be volunteering and all that stuff.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah, which is wonderful, but it's also sad because you've seen the other side where it doesn't work that way. And so what you need to try to imagine is that shift and that change is so difficult to adjust to. Imagine what it's like for the inner city kid who's grown up in a ghetto, gone to, ghetto schools, which is exactly what these kids call their schools,
mm-hmm.
ghetto schools,
mm-hmm.
and then they somehow manage to get their act together, and they're one of the 29% of Hartford students who actually graduate from high school, and then they're one of the 16% of children in the city of Hartford who are actually college-ready. They manage to get themselves to college by some miracle, and the rules are completely different.
Right.
And they don't have a clue. And it's not their fault. And yet we blame them because are they going to make it through college? It will be a miracle if they make it through college.
Well, I hear the stories about the, people saying Columbus Public, people are fleeing the schools to go to charter schools or, to private schools. And I just, what they're left to deal with really is totally different than what the other districts have to deal with.
And they do
have to deal with the whole family, the whole, all of these dysfunctions.
Exactly right. And what our education policy does now is it punishes the school as if the school is the only problem, as if the school is not a symptom of the larger problems and the untended to social problems in the larger society. And so, one of the things for example, what we do in response to the inequities that we see manifest, say, in test scores or in school graduation rates is we say, all right, well, we're going to have standards and we're going to have tests. And we're just going to mandate that everybody live up to the standards. Well, in some ways, I have a very mixed kind of view on the testing and the standards movement because I feel like on the one hand, okay, in the current structure that we have, we do need something that prevents against extreme educational neglect. And, you know, these kids are vulnerable to extreme educational neglect. These kids are vulnerable to horrible teachers and abusive principals and whatever else. This is the population we need to protect from that. However, what's happened is that people are talking about No Child Left Behind, which is basically standards and tests, and as if it is a route to true equality, when it's not. All it is a very basic protection against educational neglect, and that's all it is. And because it simply says, well, we're just going to give these tests and we're going to set this standard, and if you don't live up to it, then it's your fault, when actually it's not the teacher's fault, it's not always the principal's fault, and it's not just the school's fault. It's the society at large that's responsible for this mess. And it's all of the institutions and all of the government agencies that have a responsibility for these kids that have to do something, you know, completely outside of school.
And Don, thank you for your call. Susan, in fact, a new superintendent came into the Hartford, Connecticut school system with the idea of raising test scores, right?
Oh,
and
yeah.
You point out that this wonderful teacher, Lois Luddy, in the Simpson-Waverly Neighborhood Elementary School, was really between a rock and a hard place, because she had curious kids who wanted to know, science and wanted to know social studies, and some of these things weren't on the tests, and so she couldn't talk to them about them. It sounded like a real grind to me.
Yeah, it was, and she would. And here we have, and Dawn's call really illustrates this, that, you know, in our urban districts, we have amazing teachers who are talking in terms of, quote, you know, sneaking in some social studies, closing the door so that no one can see them doing a science experiment with the children. It's absurd, whereas you go out to the suburban district, and of course they're going to have social studies and science. Of course they're going to have a lot of field trips and recess and whatever else. So it's a completely different way of looking and thinking about how to educate children, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our callers now. Mark is next. Hello, Mark.
Good morning, Fred. Something I'd like to ask your guest, Susan. It seems not only locally but nationally, when maybe in the mid-60s the sort of organized segregation was discovered, there was forced busing, and then later there was somewhat of the voluntary busing, which she discussed. In a lot of ways, it seems to me that the busing, whether forced or voluntary, actually accelerates the segregation and the resegregation, both racially, ethnically, and culturally, economically, and it tends to undermine the children, I guess you would say, that are left behind in the non-elite school systems. And had a few thoughts on that, if she wanted to comment on it.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. There are, in some cities, there is evidence that, you know, poorly designed desegregation plans may have exacerbated white flight from certain cities, and Boston, for example, is an extreme example of that.
Yes.
But there are a lot of cities where there never was a desegregation plan and there was white flight anyway, because there have been, you know, whites have been fleeing, and the middle class now have been fleeing urban areas since, you know, World War II, after World War II, before there was, you know, anything, you know, like, you know, desegregation even on the table as a discussion point. So yeah. I think it's complicated. But the kinds of things nobody talks anymore about, you know, this thing that gets called forced busing or mandatory busing, it's just not on the table. It's not part of any civil rights agenda anymore at all.
But what people,
you know, are trying to kind of keep alive are these voluntary programs that would allow, you know, parents' choices, basically. Like, for example, the No Child Left Behind Act, actually, for all the problems I have with it, it has contained in it at least one good impulse, and that is it allows children and families who are in these impoverished, you know, what they call failing schools, to transfer to another school. But the problem is that they only allow them to transfer to the school district that they're already in. So you have a situation where if you're in Detroit or you're in Columbus, I mean, a lot of times that's going to mean, well, gee, I have the option of transferring to another high-poverty, overwhelmed school. So a lot of civil rights leaders are saying now, well, maybe we could get that provision changed to at least provide transportation and options for kids to transfer to another school district.
Yeah. It seems like sometimes what you're doing, though, you're sending a subliminal message, whether it's done by a lottery system or whatever, that whoever is the kids that are left behind, that they're expected to fail because they don't get to go on the program for the 5 or 10% of the kids that get to go to the, you know, elite suburban school. And I guess somehow we have to be accountable for the kids that are left behind in the non, you know, bus to school.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, my argument is, obviously you have to keep, you know, trying to do, you know, whatever you can. And we've got this structure of segregation, right? We've got kids who are in these schools, and we have to do the best that we possibly can by them. And I'm not arguing that nothing good can ever happen in a high-poverty, racially segregated environment. I mean, there are plenty of examples of good that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think that we fool ourselves if we think that the best that we can do is, you know, give them tests and high standards.
Yeah.
Mark, got to move on. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Your call. Do we need, Susan, simply, you know, voucher systems where parents and who are in high-poverty schools can take their kids and combine with the free busing and say, look, you know, I've got this voucher. I can send my child to a private school outside the poverty area. Is that a good idea?
I think that the voucher plans, as they've, you know, been implemented, really don't hardly ever work that way. And I don't think that there are enough good private options that would give choices, you know, adequate choices to every child who lives, you know, who goes to a public school right now in an urban area. But I do think that a lot more could be done with public school choice if there's a concerted effort to try to make it possible for as many children as possible in high-poverty schools to attend high-functioning, predominantly middle-class schools. I think a lot more can be done in that area, and there's absolutely no concerted national effort for that, despite the fact that there's enormous amounts of evidence that show the benefits of a child who's from a low-income background and in an impoverished school, and the positive things that happen in terms of education and in terms of mental health when that child transfers to a predominantly middle-class school.
Let's go with Florence. Hi, Florence. You're on the air.
Yes. I would like to bring up something that results from refugees, because I'm from the South. When the Cubans came into Florida, the ones who were more prosperous were allowed to buy restaurants, motels, and so forth, and they absolutely displaced all the blacks that had held those jobs. Huh. And then every time we do something in South America or Central America that's not successful, like the Iran-Contra, we take in refugees. And today in the South, they have as many or more illegal immigrants there taking the jobs. This is happening all over the country. And when I grew up, the white young men who wanted to earn money for college, they went up into the wheat fields, and they were the ones that harvested.
So, Florence, do you have a question about this now?
Well, I'm just pointing out that this is all over the country. The Congress is the one who makes the laws. When the agriculture subsidies came in, the rich landowners got to have the subsidies. They didn't do anything for the people who had worked for generations in the South on those lands.
Well,
I think that's a good point. And, you know, all of these things that have happened historically and the ways in which African Americans who've labored and, you know, really built the communities around them and built up the businesses, it's true. They were not afforded the kinds of benefits that the owners were, you know, especially in the South. And these kinds of things are, you know, one of the factors that leads to the legacy. We're living with the legacy of inequality now. But I want to say something about immigration. I think instead of, you know, attacking, you know, immigrants and, you know, perceiving the immigrants, whether they're undocumented or not, as the source of the problem, I think that's a displacement. I think the source of the problem is the fact that there's not fair economic policies in the United States. There's not fair labor practices in the United States that would afford good jobs, you know, for everybody.
Florence, thanks for your call. We just have 1 minute left and no time for any more calls. But So, Susan, there are some programs, as you point out, the voluntary desegregation programs in some districts, the programs that give people vouchers to move into middle-class neighborhoods and to be able to afford to rent in those neighborhoods and get out of the extreme poverty situation. A few programs that sound a bit tentative, but no widespread social concern about this, huh?
No, and actually the opposite is true. The Bush administration has actually supported plaintiffs in two cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, one from Louisville, one from Seattle, in which some parents supported by conservative, right-wing conservative groups said that because their children were denied their first choices in school choice programs, that in a voluntary school desegregation programs, that these programs were then unconstitutional because they used race as one, you know, tie-breaking mm-hmm. factor in making school assignments. And instead of siding with the school districts who are trying to achieve desegregated schools for the country, the Bush administration has gone on the side of the plaintiffs.
Okay, we must go. We're out of time. Susan Eaton, the children in room E4. Thanks very much for being with us this
hour. Thanks for having me. It was great.
WOSU 820 Columbus.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Foundation, our community's trusted philanthropic advisor, offering resources, knowledge, and expertise in charitable giving.